From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a state Senate workgroup takes another crack at road funding.
It's not like they haven't been trying on this issue. It's just that they haven't been able to get it done.
Native American culture has been struggling to survive for more than a century.
I do remember one of our elders in 1964 saying that it was a sad day when the drums went silent at Hannibal.
We look at bringing the culture back to a Potawatomi tribe in the UP, and we revisit the drive-in theater born in the Depression.
He was thinking about what would be a Depression-proof business, and he decided that the last things that people would give up would be their cars and going to the movies.
We have those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. The takeaway from the most recent United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report goes a little something like this.
Climate change is real. That humans are the principal factor in the change today. The consequences are not going to be pretty, particularly rising sea level. And the window for doing something about it is getting shorter and shorter.
Sounds pretty bleak, doesn't it? That's Henry Pollack of the University of Michigan, one of the contributors to the UN report. Put another way,
in a nutshell, it says we have our work cut out for us, and we should stop imagining that there's lots of unanswered science still in the pipeline.
So why isn't climate change the number one concern of most Americans? I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, the political battle over the science of climate change. But first, to Monday's monster thunderstorm in Metro Detroit, the second heaviest single day of rainfall since Michigan started keeping records. And that rainstorm did not just close freeways and roads and flood basements, although there was plenty of that. It focused our attention on often overlooked problems with our transportation infrastructure. Jeff Cranson is director of communications for MDOT. Jeff, seeing 12 to 14 feet of water standing there on the Reuther Freeway is an attention grabber for sure. Just why did that happen?
Well, the first thing I got to say, and you know, I want this to underscore the need for investment in all kinds of infrastructure that we've neglected, especially in our larger cities and urban areas. But you know, having said that, I think all of our pumps, even if they were at 100% good condition and all working at maximum volume, the best they could, you still would have had flooding in Detroit on Monday. I mean, this was a storm of historic proportions. I've seen some environmental assessments put this in the thousands of years in terms of the volume of rain that came in and came that fast. It's hard to say that anything could have been done really quickly to prevent that kind of flooding. But in the aftermath, certainly the problems with drainage, you know, the pumps were impeded by tree limbs and mud and unspeakable things, really, in terms of debris that that you know, caused these pumps to fail. In some cases, you know, whole embankments washed out, which meant the power failed to the pumps. So there were a lot of reasons why. But, you know, setting all that aside, it is a good thing now that people realize that we've got a number of, you know, recessed or depressed freeways in Detroit, as lots of metro areas do around the country. And that was an environmentally friendly solution, you know, back when the freeway system was developed in the mid-20th century. In terms of noise, in terms of the least disruption, you already had a highly dense, developed metro area in Detroit with housing and surface streets. So, you know, building the freeways that way wasn't cheap, but it was a good environmental solution. But that also means that, you know, when something like this happens, they become rivers instead of freeways.
And now we hear that of the 165 pump houses that MDOT oversees, 58% are considered in poor condition.
That's correct. That's it's, you know, much like we rate our roads in terms of what's good and fair and what's poor. They have similar ratings for these pumps. And 58% are in poor condition and 20% are fair and 22% are good. The goal is to get them to 90% good or fair, but you know, until we resolve this this funding challenge and decide what we're going to do as a state and what kind of state we want to be, you know, you're not going to see that 90% figure achieved.
Jeff Cranston with MDOT. Always good to talk with you. Thanks so much, Jeff.
You're welcome.
Well, more money for roads hit a great big thud earlier this summer at the state capitol. Lawmakers could not compromise on a funding fix, but now some legislators are ready to try again. Jonathan Osting with MLive joins us. Jonathan, lawmakers are still on summer recess, but there's a group of state senators, a bipartisan group we might note, and they're meeting to talk road funding. What are they up to?
Well, their main goal, and the meeting is today, their main goal is to find a new revenue source for roads. It's the same discussion they've been having for a long time, but not over the last month. As you mentioned, talks fell out in June, and there hasn't really been much action on that front since then. But Randy Richardville, Senate Minority Leader Gretchen Whitmer, and four of their colleagues are meeting today to try and wipe the slate clean, as Richardville said.
Meaning nobody seemed to like the ideas we had. Let's see if we can come up with something that everybody will be able to get on board with.
Exactly. And, you know, Richardville mentioned some ideas yesterday. None of them were exactly novel. So I don't imagine there's going to be any radically new ideas to come out of this. But hopefully maybe they'd be able to cobble together some pre-existing ideas into a larger package.
Yeah, I'm wondering, with all the stunning video we've seen out of the Detroit area, the tremendous road flooding and pump houses failing with this week's torrential rain, any idea or any hint that that's given anyone in Lansing maybe a greater sense of urgency about transportation infrastructure problems and funding?
Well, Democrats certainly brought it up on the floor yesterday. There was a separate vote on a wolf hunting initiative, and Democrats questioned, you know, why the Republican majority was taking that up at this time, considering the flooding and, you know, pre-existing road issues. Randy Richardville said that certainly the flooding is a problem, and it's probably going to cost MDOT some more money. But he said, you know, road funding has been a pressing issue for months. It's not like they haven't been trying on this issue. It's just that they haven't been able to get it done.
Are you getting a sense from any of them that there is a timeline in mind for them? Would they like to try to get this nailed down before the November election, or are they going to wait until they're lame duck?
I imagine they'll wait till lame duck. I mean, certainly the hope would be to get it done as quickly as possible, but that seems pretty unlikely. I mean, this is the only scheduled work group so far of the summer. And, you know, Democrats even suggested a little bit of skepticism about how meaningful it would really be. There's no members of the House who are going to be in this work group. Nobody from the governor's office is going to be in the work group. So even if the Senate comes up with an idea like they did in June, there's no guarantee the other chamber or the governor's office will be on board.
Jonathan Osting, MLive Lansing reporter. Always good to talk with you. Thanks, Jonathan.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Native American culture has been struggling to survive for well over a century. For a Potawatomi tribe in the Upper Peninsula, tribal culture nearly vanished around the 1940s. Michigan Radio's Emily Fox reports from the Hannahville Reservation about efforts to bring tribal culture back.
Tribes from the Great Lakes region gather for the annual summer powwow at the Hannahville Reservation just outside of Escanaba. Inside a big circle in a grassy outdoor arena, dozens of dancers display the moves of their ancestors. They dance with their chests hunched forward. Their feet move with a rhythmic skip that kind of looks like a chicken walk. Everyone in the circle is dressed in elaborate regalia, decorated with feathers, beads, ribbons, and bells. Women dance with small aluminum cones that hang off fringes of their dresses that jingle to the sound of the drum.
The drum is actually the heartbeat of our Mother Earth. It is also the heartbeat of the community, as one would say.
Earl Meshigoud is the cultural director and spiritual leader of the Hannahville Indian community. He says things weren't always as culturally vibrant as they are now.
I do remember one of our elders in 1964 saying that it was a sad day when the drums went silent at Hannahville.
For a century, it was illegal in the United States for Native Americans to practice their religion or ceremonies. And during that time, Native American children were taken from their family and sent to boarding schools. The boarding schools were set up with a mission to, quote, kill the Indian and save the man. Meshigoud says if kids were caught practicing ceremonies or speaking in their native language, they were beaten.
Many of the people lost their hearing or eyesight from being beaten. Well, that's just the way it was in that boarding school.
For about three decades, the Hannahville Indian community was without its culture. But in the 70s, the American Indian Religious Freedom Act was passed, and boarding schools dwindled. At that time, cultural and spiritual leaders from the Great Lakes, Plains, and Canadian tribes came to Hannahville to bring the culture back.
They started our fires way back in that time and invited some medicine men down from Canada to help us out. And one guy came from Saskatchewan, and I will always remember him because he sat on the ground in the winter and he started crying, and he told us that his tears were for our people here because we had completely lost our way.
This is Eric Halfaday. He was born and raised in Hannahville. He's 29 years old and has been drumming and singing since he was 9. He's strikingly tall. He's 6'7". He's wearing a Redskins ball cap, and underneath, his long ponytail hangs halfway down his back. He says it's awful that drumming was almost lost at Hannahville.
It's really sad. I feel that somebody was slipping for a point in time, and I'm glad I'm old enough now. I will never let that happen again.
Halfaday's drum group is made up of guys mostly in their 20s. It's this generation that never had to endure boarding schools or federal policies that banned them from their culture.
The drum itself, I would say that's what's keeping Native America alive, really. It's making the young boys want to sing, the young girls want to dance and sing. I think it's our future, really. That's the universal way of getting us together, I guess.
The leaders who brought the culture back to Hannahville have passed away, and Halfaday says it's his generation that needs to make sure the drumming stays and keeps the culture alive for generations. For Stateside, I'm Emily Fox.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The drive-in theater. Whether you were a little kid jumping into your PJs before mom and dad packed up the station wagon and took the family out, or a teenager looking for a little privacy on a date, the drive-in theater could be a pretty magical place. The very first drive-in opened in New Jersey in 1933, but it sure didn't take long for Michiganders to catch on to the drive-in. They opened up in virtually every corner of the state. My next guest channeled his happy boyhood memories of going to the drive-in to come up with a book for the Images of America series. It's called Michigan's Drive-In Theaters. Harry Skirdla, good to have you with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
What's your early memories of going to the drive-in?
It was the early 60s, and my mother was a housewife. And what do you do when you want to entertain the kids? So she would pack us up often in our pajamas into the big green station wagon and take us to the drive-in.
I didn't even know when I wrote that introduction. I didn't know that's exactly how you experienced it. I know we did because you'd hop up on the roof and watch on the roof. I know you're an engineer. You're an historic preservation consultant. What propelled you to take this deep dive and write this book, tracking the history of Michigan's drive-ins?
Well, beginning in the late 70s, the writing was on the wall that they probably weren't going to be around forever. I think maybe one or two had been torn down. So I collared a friend of mine who was a photographer, and we went around on his motorcycle to operating drive-ins at dusk and took photos of them. That was the late 70s, and there was a sort of a vast purge of drive-ins around 84 and 85.
Why was that?
I don't think that this was something that was a conspiracy against them.
Like a concerted movement.
Right. It wasn't the anti-drive-in forces run amok. It was that a number of things were just conspiring against them right at that time. And a lot of them were torn down simultaneously because a number of them were owned by the same chains.
What were some of the things conspiring against them?
Well, when Hollingshead opened his first drive-in.
And who is that?
Richard Hollingshead. He was a sort of entrepreneur in Camden, New Jersey. His father and grandfather operated a successful company that manufactured auto products. But it was the Depression, and he had an income, and he worked for the company. But he was thinking about what would be a Depression-proof business. And as he thought about it, he made a little list. And he decided that the last things that people would give up would be their cars and going to the movies. He did some research, and he talked to people at RCA to see if it was possible to put speakers up at a screen and have people listen to them from, you know, without being deafened in the front row, if you could hear it in the back. I talked to his son years ago, and his son distinctly remembered his father setting up a screen between two trees in their driveway and setting a 16-millimeter projector on the hood of the car and sitting in their car to see if you could watch a movie that way.
So early test marketing was done on the family.
Yes, it was his family that were the guinea pigs.
But he made it happen, and he opens this one, in the first one in 1933. How long did it take for the drive-in to make its way to Michigan?
Well, it sort of gradually snowballed. He had a patent on it. Theoretically, people had to pay to his license, but that never worked out very well, and he was constantly suing people. And as it turned out, the second drive-in ever built on the planet wasn't one that he knew anything about. It was a guy who went to his theater and said, well, I could do that, and went back to Orfield, Pennsylvania, where he was from, and built his own drive-in.
Which I think you note is still open?
Schenkweiler's Drive-In, yes. It's still open.
So that one survived.
And one of the problems that Hollings had had with his first drive-in, and one of the reasons it only lasted a few years before he sold it, was it was very loud because it only had central speakers next to the screen, and there were neighbors. His son told me there was also a problem with, imagine you're watching a Western and somebody shoots the bad guy. Well, he would be on the ground before the people in the back rows heard the gunshot.
A little delay there.
And then the people in the houses heard the gunshots, and they didn't like that much either.
But ultimately, the sound problems got ironed out.
Well,
they
fixed that.
The little speakers.
Hanging
on the window.
In the book, there's a picture of an intermediate step. They tried intermediate things, a sort of buried in the ground under the car where they thought it would speak up through the floorboards. Oh, that was a good idea. And there was another version that had clusters of speakers about every four cars or something like that. Schenkweiler's fixed the problem, though, early on. They still had the speakers by the screen, but they piped the sound back to the neighbors' porches. So the neighbors who could see the screen could just sit on their porch and listen to their own speaker for free.
Kind of like people living around Wrigley Field in
yes,
Chicago.
Yes, exactly.
I'm talking with Harry Skirdla, who is a historic preservation consultant and an engineer. And his book for the Images of America series is Michigan's Drive-In Theaters, really tracking the fascinating design and history of the drive-ins that really ultimately made their way all over Michigan. I'm wondering, did you see regional differences in the design or size or amenities of drive-in theaters in Michigan?
Regional within the country, but not so much within the state. It was more, there were a finite number of architects. There are pictures in the book of the Dearborn and the Beltline and some others. Well, if you look at them, or at the time that I took the pictures, you're driving along and you see this drive-in and go, wait a minute, that looks just like... Yeah, there were a lot of them where I think the architect just said... Well, yeah, sure.
Stamp them out.
That's right. I mean, it's one set of blueprints, so I'll accept commissions for this.
It was really an experience that was more than the movie, wasn't it? The amenities were so much a part of it.
Those old enough to remember going to them, or those still fortunate enough to live near them. The picture was never the best. I mean, you could have gone to a good indoor theater and had a brighter picture. And if you're sitting in your car, there's always a question of whether it'll rain or bugs or, of course, the days of the in-car speaker are pretty much past. There may still be a few. The Capri drive-in out at Coldwater, in addition to radio sound, they kept some in the back, but then later they added a second screen, and when they did that, they just gave up. Frankly, I'm as nostalgic as the next person, but those speakers were never very good. And if you're listening on your car radio, you can actually listen in decent stereo, where that wasn't an option. Although they did make, back in the 50s, supposed stereo in-car speakers that had two or even three speakers in a cluster, and yet it still hooked on the window.
Huh.
So to hear decent stereo effect, you'd kind of have to face the window, which... didn't seem like a good idea.
Not when the screen was straight ahead. And, of course, there were the playgrounds and the merry-go-rounds and the big, big concession stands, because those of us who went remember the parade of dancing popcorn boxes.
And if you go to one now, you are more likely than not to still see that. I'm not quite sure where they get them now. The last time I went to the Capri, they still had the talking hot dog and everything in between. And the print was not bad. So I don't – of course, the Capri has converted to digital, so it may be a digital file. But I was amazed because the concession stands are still essentially unchanged and the concession food is essentially unchanged in a good way. Some drive-ins, once upon a time, were kind of bad about, well, we didn't sell the hot dog. Throw it back in the refrigerator. We'll try again tomorrow.
It was a different era in food safety standards. When you think about some, imagine offering pony rides and merry-go-rounds, depends on how deep the owner's wallet was.
Well, right. It was amazingly common, especially when a drive-in opened. Pony rides were always a big thing because you can lure people in. And some
and
of them kept the
kids
the
were watching
rides.
The Westerns. We were watching,
right.
You know, Davy Crockett and...
The other things, though, amazingly expensive sort of kiddie amusement park rides, miniature railroads, circular boat ride with actual water in it, and even the smallest had teeter-totters and swings and things like that. It spread also into other amenities. Some of the earlier ones, when it was more of a novelty and they could afford the huge staff, the Gratiot, for example, they had people who roamed around the lot washing your windows for free.
You mentioned diaper services for young
diaper
moms.
Diaper services, bottle warmers. It had developed into a huge, elaborate thing by the time the drive-ins reached their peak in about 58.
And how many did we have in Michigan when they were at their peak?
Well, there aren't any reliable figures. There are lots of figures, but they don't all agree with each other.
What do you believe?
About 130 at a time, about 160 total.
So from that 140 to 160 or so high, how many do we have today?
Today we have, at this very minute, as far as I know, there are 8. The first drive-in in Michigan opened in 38, and it was the 10th in the country or in the world. That was the one that became eventually known as the East Side in Detroit. The second one in the state was the one that became known as the West Side, which was up on 8 Mile. All of the drive-ins were originally called drive-in theater. And once you had more than one drive-in theater, you kind of had to start calling them something.
Ours was the Miracle Mile. Telegraph Square Lake, we're probably about where Costco is sitting right
and
now.
And that Miracle Mile was one of the most deluxe drive-ins because it was a fairly late one. And they got better and better at it as they went. Most of them were built just after the war, probably between, say, 47 and 50. As I said, it peaked in 58, and at that point, there were probably 3,700 in the country. What killed them essentially was they were constructed of necessity on the outskirts of towns where the property was cheap on roads and hopefully intersections of roads that were main thoroughfares so the traffic could get there, but that they could afford the acres of land that they required. Well, these cities kept on growing over the years. And in the case of the Gratiot, ironically, the same architect, the architectural firm that designed the Gratiot in 48, was designing the strip mall that replaced it in 85. Well, I went and talked to them at the time. And the senior architect said the drive-in was still making money, but they gave them $10 million for the property. No drive-in's going to make $10 million.
It is a fascinating study as to how there was a moment in time and then time moved on. The book is at Michigan's Drive-In Theaters for the Images of America series. Harry Skirdla, who is an historic preservation consultant, so his heart is certainly in the place, and also the kid who was in the pajamas in the station wagon enjoying the drive-in. Harry, it was good to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Using music to bring communities together and to help kids discover music, not only as listeners, but as potential musicians. That's the idea behind a new foundation called Walk the Beat. There's a big event coming up in Grand Haven, Spring Lake, and Ferrisburg to help launch this foundation. Grand Haven musician and songwriter David Palmer is here. Now he's founder of the Walk the Beat Foundation. Good to have you with us, David.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
What gave you the idea for Walk the Beat?
Right now, the mission of Walk the Beat Foundation is to get any child involved with music. If a child doesn't have an instrument, we would like to give them an instrument. If they already have an instrument, let's get them some lessons. If they've already had lessons, let's get them a little demo tape, you know, and just try to work with each individual at wherever they are on the path.
Mm-hmm. And knowing that the desire's there, so build
correct,
on that.
And we just want to help advance whatever passion they have. And some of them are really passionate about what they're doing.
Well, you've got an event coming up August 16th. It's a music festival over the Tri-Cities. So it's covering Grand Haven, Spring Lake, and Ferrisburg. And it, too, is called Walk the Beat, this
Correct.
Festival. Who's involved and how is it structured?
There's 40 different locations in the Grand Haven, Spring Lake, and Ferrisburg area. On August 16th, from noon to 5, each one of those places are going to have an open house. The first 2.5 hours will be soloists or duets. The second 2.5 hours will be full bands. Hmm. The idea is that people go from location to location, voting on bands. They'll be able to vote with their smartphones. And seeing what all these different venues have. I mean, these are all small businessmen. So what we're trying to do here, when I've been a small businessman almost all of my life. So I came up with this idea and I said, how about if I can get, you know, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people to come right to your door?
And do it by having musicians perform.
Correct. So we can help the players,
yeah.
Help the musicians, and then help the people in our whole community, have them come and see what services that are available from small businessmen who are the people that are taking care of your town.
So you're trying to really not only shed a spotlight on musicians, because you've got, what, I see over 80 musical performances and over 300
yeah.
musicians,
yeah.
but also on these businesses in the Tri-Cities area.
Correct. The two of the hardest ways to make a living, small businessman or a musician.
Very true.
So why not put these guys together and help the whole community at the same time, give our musicians a lot of promotional opportunities along with the small businessmen.
For people who say, you know, I'm going to go to Grand Rapids for Art Prize because I want to see the art. There's no that would be the same kind of person that would say, hey, let's go to Grand Haven and let's go to Spring Lake and Ferrisburg and
Definitely.
Listen to music.
No.
So a music festival, but not your typical big crowd of people in a field
correct,
with mud.
Correct. You know, you go from place to place and you just meet a bunch of people. And what's kind of cool is that every one of these open houses will have their own type of party going on.
You're a businessman. You also are a musician-songwriter. Mm-hmm. From your heart, why do you feel it is so important to get these kids in Michigan hooked into music and to learn it and give them a chance to perform it?
Well, music is really from the cradle to the grave. I truly believe it is part of your being. You need it. It helps express yourself so much better than keeping it inside. And I think these young people, first of all, it's just good for their brain. Just it's the left and right side working. It's good for their social skills. It is good for mathematics. You know, you can go on and on with all the studies that have claimed that music is just good for you as a person.
David Palmer is a musician and businessman who is a founder of Walk the Beat, the foundation, and the big festival, the Tri-Cities Festival, that'll be August 16th from 12 to 5. Some 40 business open houses all throughout Grand Haven, Spring Lake, and Ferrisburg with literally over 300 musicians performing. You can get all the details at walkthebeat.org. David Palmer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Climate scientists around the world have been issuing a steady drumbeat of warnings and data pointing to profound changes and shifts that have already begun because of climate change. Yet a UK survey finds when it comes to climate denial, the United States leads the world. Only 54% of Americans agree that human activity is largely causing the climate change we're currently seeing. Why is the U.S. the world leader in climate denial? And how can scientists and policymakers convert the deniers? Henry Pollack is an emeritus professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan. He shares the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with former Vice President Al Gore for his work with the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Welcome back to Stateside, Professor Pollack.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And we're joined by Edward Maybach. He's a professor and he's director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Edward, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Henry, I want to start with you. Did it surprise you to see that figure that here we are, United States, number one in the world in climate denial?
No, that's not a surprise. I've been aware of that trend now for more than two decades. and it's a reality. There are a lot of complex reasons for it, but nevertheless, we are the leader.
And Edward, when I see that the percentage at one time was all the way up to 72% in the early 2000s, why the slide backward?
It's a complicated situation, but it basically comes down to one word, politics. Some of our political leaders have decided this is something they don't want to deal with, and the way they have chosen to do so is by denying its reality. And a lot of Americans take their cues from our political leaders.
Then I also noticed that numbers 2 and 3 in climate denial, respectively, were Great Britain and Australia, while at the other end, 93% of the people in China agreed that human activity is causing this. Why is climate denial so strong in English-speaking countries, do you think, Henry?
Well, I think it has to do with the political systems, and the English-speaking world has much in common in their political systems. I think that the debates that go on and the awareness of the debates that the body politic, you know, has does make this a much more volatile, opinionated environment.
What do you think, Edward?
Yeah, we're strong believers here in the United States in the free market system. And unfortunately, climate change has been misconstrued, I believe, as a threat to free market ideology. And that really is the driver why, I mean, you can roll back the clock for about 15 years until the late 90s, and Democrats and Republicans pretty much saw the issue in the same way. About 2 out of 3 of both groups were convinced that climate change was real and seemed serious. In the intervening years, Democrats, almost all of them, have become convinced of the reality of climate change, and most of them feel it's quite serious. And unfortunately, Republicans have sort of moved in the other direction. So now we're down to about a third or 40% of Republicans who see climate change as real. So we've got the conflation of the problem with the solution in the minds of Republicans. And fortunately, I think there is an opportunity going forward to deconflate those two ideas. You know, let's dismiss the scientific reality of the situation we're facing, but let's bring the best free market solutions forward and put them on the table and let's have a real conversation about them.
But then, meantime, taking it out of the policymaking level and getting very, very granular, and this is purely anecdotal, but I am thinking of someone I know, have known for a long time, and inevitably, when the subject of climate change and global warming would come up, there would be a sneer from him, and then he would turn that immediately into a sneer at Vice President Gore and then at President Obama. So there we've got people in the homes of America doing that.
I think that you've made a very important point there. A lot of our acceptance of message depends on who the messenger is. And you've pointed out that Vice President Gore has detractors. He also has a large band of followers. I can give you another example of this messenger effect. An earlier environmental issue, the creation of the ozone hole over the Antarctic, took place during President Reagan's presidency, and his vice president was George H.W. Bush. When the issue of the scientific understanding of it and the cause of it became clear, the U.S. did not back away from it. And the question was why. And one insight that has been called to my attention is that President Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of Great Britain at the time, were very good friends and influenced each other greatly. Well, Margaret Thatcher was an industrial chemist before she was the Prime Minister. And when the scientific evidence was presented to her, she said, oh, of course, we've got to do something about it. And Ronald Reagan said, you know, Maggie, if you say we have to do something about it, we should. And the USA marched ahead on that, and we had an international treaty, the Montreal Protocol, that went into effect. And that issue now is largely in remediation.
But we don't see this country marching ahead in unison with much of anything, do we, Edward?
No, we don't. Unfortunately, Capitol Hill's fairly gridlocked on pretty much all issues that face us at the moment. Certainly, this issue is front and center in terms of gridlock. But, Cynthia, I'd actually like to introduce another point, which is, you know, while the U.S. may lead the world in terms of the proportion of our citizens who don't yet understand that climate change is a real problem, 64% of the public does understand that climate change is real versus 19% who don't yet understand. So I just want to make it really clear that the majority of Americans really are at a state where they accept the fact that there is a problem to be dealt with. unfortunately, in the public dialogue right now is so often about the wrong question. The question of, is it happening or isn't it? Is it human caused or isn't it? The useful dialogue would be, what do we want to do about it? And that the really interesting thing we find in our polling data, there is a larger proportion of Americans who would actually like to see our elected officials move forward and start making decisions about how to deal with climate change than there are citizens who are convinced that human-caused climate change is occurring. Meaning, there are plenty of people out there who still aren't yet sure about climate change, but if it is real, it sounds bad to them, and they just assume that our leaders do what we pay them to do, which is lead.
I'll come back to the messenger issue here. And just recently, there was a plan of action put out by Michael Bloomberg and Henry Paulson, the former Secretary of the Treasury under President Bush. And they had this plan called, or it's titled, Risky Business. And it says, as you know, business people, we have to assess risk. And so let's look at climate change, see what the risk is. How can we plan for the risk? And both of those people, Bloomberg and Paulson, are Republicans. And so, again, there's an attempt to have the messenger have the credibility with the people who are facing these issues.
I'm talking with Henry Pollack, who's an emeritus professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan, also sharing the Nobel Peace Prize with former Vice President Al Gore for his work in climate change, and also talking with Edward Maybach, who's a professor and director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. I saw a term as I was kind of researching our conversation today. Climate optimists, as in, oh, yeah, it's real, but it's nothing to worry about. Edward, where did that come from, and who's buying into that?
I actually haven't heard that term before, but I see people in our surveys that do comport with that idea, that, yes, it's real, but I'm not terribly worried about it. We see that over half of Americans are worried about climate change, but only 15% would characterize themselves as very worried about climate change. Conversely, when I speak to my climate science colleagues, most of them strike me as pretty darn worried that we are creating changes in the climate that human civilization arose in, changes that are going to be really quite challenging for human civilization to continue to thrive in. So I, as a social scientist working on the issue of climate change, I see a fairly profound disconnect between the level of worry that I see among average Americans and the level of worry I see among my climate science colleagues.
That's absolutely right. Scientists look at the observations of the natural world, and they see big changes taking place now. I think a lot of the disconnect for people who seem disengaged or not worried is that they think the consequences are all long in the future. And in fact, the consequences are happening right now. We're seeing climate change globally, but everything that we call global climate change is expressed locally. It reminds me of Tip O'Neill's old statement that all politics are local. Ultimately, all climate change is local, too. And people have to see the changes are happening in their environment for them really to get engaged with it and recognize that it's a problem right now, right at home.
Edward, does your data find that the message is not being delivered in the right way to make it believable to the public?
Yes, in a word, yes. But let me give you a little bit of context behind that. What we find is that the average American thinks there's a lot of disagreement among the experts about whether or not human-caused climate change is happening. In reality, there's an overwhelming agreement among the experts, a scientific consensus among the experts that human-caused climate change is occurring. So this most fundamental of ideas or of facts has been misconstrued or misunderstood by many members of the public. And that's not an accident. There's been a very aggressive misinformation campaign to suggest that there is disagreement among the experts, when in fact no such disagreement exists. Our research has shown that members of the public who believe that there is a lot of disagreement among the experts are less likely to be personally convinced that climate change is real, is human-caused, is a serious threat to people, to human beings, and is solvable. So the misinformation campaign, mischaracterizing the scientific consensus, has unfortunately been all too effective. So that's on one side of the issue. On the other side of the issue, I don't actually see a systematic effort to educate the American people about the realities of climate change, as Dr. Pollack was suggesting, about the fact that it's happening here and now. It is, in fact, a threat for our future, but it's also currently manifesting in every region of the country. And there isn't really a systematic effort to share with the American people what we know about climate change, which is really curious to me, considering I spent the first 25 years of my career working in the field of public health. And in public health, we spend a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a fair amount of money educating the public about the threats, the proven, the known threats to the public's health and well-being, like tobacco and seatbelt use and substance abuse prevention and this sort of thing, whereas we don't yet see that kind of sustained, concerted effort to educate the public about the risks of climate change.
Why is that, Henry?
I can't say for sure, but one of the things that Professor Maybach has written about is somewhat of a disconnect between the weathermen on TV and the story of climate change. The public, of course, much of their science comes from the local meteorologist. I think there's a general misunderstanding about the role of meteorologists and the role of climatologists. It's kind of like the two blind people examining the elephant, and each is seeing a different story. The meteorologists focus on the here and now, you know, the immediate aspects of our natural environment, what's happening today, tomorrow, and next week. Whereas the climatologist is looking at the long-term view. It reminds me a little bit of a Wall Street analogy between day traders and someone who manages a retirement portfolio. The retirement portfolio manager has a 30 or 40-year perspective, and the day trader doesn't have a 30-minute perspective sometimes. So each has their role, but if I was interested in long-term climate change, I wouldn't be consulting a day trader for the best advice and insight.
What about behavior of the human brain? When you think of just what we're being bombarded with, we civilians, whether it's news stories about immigration challenges to poverty to bloodshed in the Middle East to all of these problems, is it understandable where people's brains just are too saturated to accept that climate change is here and now? It doesn't seem immediate. It's easy to put it on the back burner and let somebody down the road in history worry about it.
Right. Professor Danny Kahneman from Princeton wrote a fabulous book called Thinking Fast and Slow, and I hope lots of your listeners have read it or will read it, because it's a really fabulous accounting of the fact that every one of us has two different information processing systems in our brain. One of those systems is highly attuned to analytical learning, learning through numbers, learning through analysis, and that's how we have learned about climate change. But the other information processing system that is in every one of our brains is what is called an experiential learning system. It's how we learn through our day-to-day experiences. And Professor Kahneman calls the one experiential learning system one, and the other analytical learning system two. System one pretty much consistently trumps system two. In other words, what we learn from our day-to-day experience becomes much more vivid, much more compelling to us, and ultimately shapes our worldview more strongly than does anything that we're privy to through analytical learning.
It sounds like what I'm hearing you both say is we do need to try to seize on those teachable moments. Detroit's coping with a 5 to 6 inch rainfall that's got 14 foot standing water floods under freeways because of the extreme weather event. So you're saying taking this and turning to people like the weathercasters, who aren't political and they're welcomed into people's homes each and every night over dinner.
One of the events that takes place fairly frequently now down in Professor Maybach's neighborhood is the flooding around Norfolk, Virginia at high tide. Norfolk, Virginia is a place that's experiencing rising sea level in a more profound way than many others, because the ground is also subsiding at the same time that the sea is rising. But there are times at high tide when people can't park their cars at their houses because the streets are underwater. And those are well known and certainly publicized in the newspapers in Virginia. And that too is a teachable moment about rising sea level.
That connection isn't made often enough.
Yeah, there was a lot of media coverage of this issue in the late 2000s, 2006, 2007, around the time when Professor Pollack won his Nobel Prize, and media coverage of the issue dropped dramatically. For example, on nightly news, the rate of climate change stories in nightly news dropped 80% after that spike in 2007, 2008. And the same is true, or not quite as deep, but a very large decline in print coverage as well. But the coverage has started to rebound. I actually participated in a wonderful reporting exercise called the National National Climate Assessment. We released our report in May of this year, and this is anecdotal as opposed to based on numbers. I've seen a really strong rebound in coverage of climate change recently, this summer, and I see a lot of stories that are consistent with what Professor Pollack is calling for, namely coverage of the local ramifications of climate change, not the global ramifications, which is very hard for people to stay interested in, or the future ramifications, which again is very hard for people to hold their attention to. But if you talk about the here and now, the ways in which climate change is influencing our neighborhood today, that's a story that's of interest to almost everyone.
Edward Maybach, professor and director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and Henry Pollack, emeritus professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan, who is sharing the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with former President Al Gore for his work on climate change. Really a pleasure to talk with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Stateside was produced and directed today by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Kayla Steinberg, and Michelle Hahn. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.